Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we take a look back at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago with media historian Heather Hendershot. She is joined by fellow historian Kevin Boyle to discuss her book, When the News Broke, Chicago, 1968, and the Polarizing of America. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Hello. And welcome to the American Writers Festival's next program here on our partner stage. I'm Carol Mioseth, and I'm the Institutional Giving Manager at the museum. Our next program is presented by our friends at the Newberry Library. Later this year, Chicago will host the Democratic National Convention as it did in 1968 when the convention became the focal point for protests against the war in Vietnam. In Heather Hendershot's new book about that polarizing time, she examines what those events did to trust in the American press and where we are now as a result. She is the Cardis Collins Professor of Communication Studies and Journalism at Northwestern University. To interview her, we welcome 1960s historian and Northwestern University Professor of American History, Kevin Boyle.
First of all, I just want to say how honored I am to get to share the stage with you and to have the chance to talk with you about this really fabulous book. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Let's start with 68 itself. The 68 convention, of course, is this really iconic moment in the 60s because I think for so many people it represents the great turmoil of that period. But you're arguing in the book that it also has a meaning, the convention and the media coverage of the convention has a meaning that extends well beyond the 60s. So why don't you give us a brief sense of that turmoil and then how you see the repercussions of the coverage spreading past 68?
Yeah, absolutely. It's wild how that the convention and especially the seat streams and the Battle of Michigan Avenue, police beat protesters for 17 minutes and we saw it on TV. It's become like iconic of the 60s, and you'll just be watching any documentary and there'll be a flash of those blue Chicago police helmets, right? So it's had that staying power. But I'm looking at it more specifically as a distinct historical event, not just this 60s moment, but like, you know, what happened in terms of mainstream media and certain shifts after the convention. And I see it as a kind of tipping point moment where towards the notion that the mainstream media is infused with some kind of liberal bias, an idea that we still see weaponized by the right in different ways today than certainly than we did in 68. But I argue that before the convention, the notion that mainstream media was liberal biased was a regional feeling, like segregationists, southern states did not like the representation of the civil rights movement, and to some extent an extremist feeling or a right-wing sentiment. Someone like William F. Buckley Jr. in the pages of National Review would talk about liberal media bias. Most people, whether they identified as conservative or Democrat or Republican or whatever, liberal, you know, they wrote letters to the network, and I've read a lot of these letters, and they say, well, you made this mistake on this particular issue. You were too liberal or too conservative about this or that, or you got some facts wrong. But they understood the mainstream media and network news, TV news, as striving for fairness and objectivity as much as they possibly could. And when they made mistakes, it was because they were human, but not because they themselves were flawed or liberal. After the convention, this idea of liberal media bias becomes mainstreamed. It's not just, you know, far right kind of idea, and nationalized, something that you see outside of the South. And there's a couple reasons why that happens. One is the way that Daley, Mayor Daley, attacked the news media. He's a Democrat, but he helps Hubert Humphrey lose inadvertently and helps Nixon win. And the other way that this idea becomes mainstream and nationalized is by Nixon himself, who really kind of rides this horse over the finish line that the media is against him. And obviously that accelerates in the course of his time in office.
So one of the fascinating aspects of the story you're telling, and you've just mentioned Richard Daley. I don't know if most of you know Richard Daley. Just thought I should check.
An icon.
Is that prior to the convention, the people who seemed to fear the press most were actually Democrats. Richard Daley, Lyndon Johnson. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about Richard Daley and the way in which he tried to limit the press at the convention.
Yeah. I mean, going into the convention, he has negative, and long before the convention, he has a very negative idea towards mass media. He's a machine politician. He's a boss. And he doesn't have to really use media to campaign for office. Whoever's on the Democratic slate, he feels pretty confident is going to win. So the media before elections for Daley is door-to-door people with flyers and billboards saying you should vote, you know, but he's not invested in I've got to get on radio and television and spread my message. He feels that the newspapers and the local media are pretty much against him. And he feels even more strongly that the national news media is against him, which is not fully rational because Chicago's actually doing pretty well in the press compared to New York City under John Lindsay, where there's like a garbage strike and a teacher strike and at one point a grave digger strike, you know, like it's a city that's spiraling downwards and Chicago's doing okay in terms of media image. But he just kind of assumes the worst. And then he exacerbates the whole situation by setting up what I call a kind of infrastructure of censorship, where he radically reduces the number of floor passes that the networks can have, like to like one quarter of what they would normally have to be on a convention floor interviewing delegates. Most importantly, he fails to settle an electrical workers' strike that he might have made happen. Like a lot of people feel that he actually made the strike happen because he was in control and there weren't many strikes with someone who had the unions kind of in his back pocket. This not resolving the electrical workers' strike meant that insufficient number of telephones were installed. It's hard to imagine how important this was when you talk to contemporary people like anyone who didn't, you know, grew up with a phone in their pocket, what it was like to need a payphone. And I find myself talking to my undergrads being like, a payphone is a machine you put money in and then you, you know, a payphone. But they needed like thousands and thousands of extra phones just for journalists to phone in stories. And really importantly, on the convention floor itself. Because all the delegate, you know, you've got 50 states and, you know, Puerto Rico and some non-voting people, they all have a telephone on kind of mounted on a post so that they can confer with each other. And the peace delegates who, you know, want a different plank in Vietnam need to talk to each other to strategize. So by not having enough phones, you prevent that from happening. Daley made sure that only Illinois and Texas, who was one of his friends, right, LBJ, and a few other states that he felt were on his side, they got phone lists, so they saw each other's phone numbers. Other people, they didn't give them phone lists. Some of them didn't even know their own phone number on the floor, right? So that's inside the convention hall. Then outside, there weren't enough electrical lines installed for the networks to do live street coverage. This is huge. At a convention, you expect, if you are Walter Cronkite at CBS, that your reporters are going to be in the street talking to people, especially with all these protests that they knew was going to happen. They knew there's going to be a lot of action in the street. No live coverage. So when you have protesters chanting, you know, the whole world is watching, it's more like the whole world will be watching in 3 or 4 hours because they're taking these images and literally putting them on motorcycle carriers back to the amphitheater and then editing and adding some explanatory voiceover sometimes, getting stuff on the air 3 or 4 hours later. So it was a huge way to censor journalists, literally in terms of trying to keep images off the air, but also it was to kind of get at their morale because you have Cronkite and Huntley Brinkley and NBC on TV kind of holding in, like letting out little tidbits about the problems with coverage, but not overemphasizing it because they don't want to be the story. They want to tell the story. But they are kind of crushed by Daley's clampdown, his censorship of news.
So you've just raised another really important point in the book, which is that the vast majority of the coverage, the convention lasts 4 days, and the vast majority of the coverage is what's going on inside the convention, yeah, not what's happening out on the street.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you make a real point that in some ways, But the major networks, CBS and NBC in particular, didn't quite get the story completely inside the convention.
Yeah, I argue, I think they did a pretty good job most of the time, but they definitely made mistakes. And some of the mistakes were inside the convention hall, where on the first day, they, and I go like day by day, it's like a micro history, there is a crisis where Georgia delegates with Julian Bond are challenging the regular delegates under Governor Lester Maddox, if anyone's heard of him, infamous racist fried chicken restaurateur who became governor of Georgia based on keeping black people out of his fried chicken restaurant. And he had hand-selected delegates at the convention, and you have a black delegation showing up who wants to be seated instead. And it is a strong story for the networks the first day, because Lester Maddox is it's nationally known racist, kind of George Wallace Monkey, you know, kind of a bumpkin. He's easy, you know, he's an easy villain for TV. And then Julian Bond is this young, handsome black politician. So it's a great TV story. And it's an important, strong political story. They tell that story. The next day, there's a challenge from the Alabama delegation. And also very important, also about voting rights, voter suppression. And CBS the story's too complicated for them. There's too many different players. They don't have a clear hero villain figure. And it points to the limits of TV storytelling. And they go off on a tangent all day that maybe Ted Kennedy is going to be drafted, which was not far-fetched, but they were wrong. If they had been right, they would have huge scoop and way ahead of NBC, but they were wrong. He wasn't drafted. But, you know, it was possible because there were a lot of Bobby Kennedy supporters there and he'd been assassinated and a lot of people were like, we want Kennedy. So that was a mistake they did of not really getting at all of the voter suppression issues that were happening. They did do a good job inside of trying to cover the peace delegates because that became a censorship story and they were really invested in that. And I'll tell you how it was a censorship story because people who wanted to hold up peace signs, who wanted to change Johnson's policy in Vietnam, right, and end the war, they weren't allowed to bring the signs in. You could only come in to the Chicago Amphitheater with Hubert Humphrey signs. So they're searching everyone's purses, not only for weapons, but also for, you know, Eugene McCarthy literature, Bobby Kennedy signs. And one night, the pro-peace delegates, literally, they take pages of the Chicago Tribune and they print peace signs on them, like in black ink overnight. They dry by morning and they say, like, stop the war. They fold them up into little pieces and stick them in their pants and their shoes and their hats, wherever they can to sneak them in. And then at a key moment, they all unfurl these pages of newspapers and you can see the fold lines in them, right? So this is a good story for the networks to cover because they're like, freedom of information, you know, it's exactly in line with their interests. So they do that well, but they do drop the ball, I think, on some of those voting rights issues for sure.
Yeah, race, they have trouble with. The war is an easier, in some
ways,
easier story to tell in that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have to go outside the convention, too.
We do.
And one of the fascinating points you make is really how little time the networks spend, for some of the reasons you just described, on the protests in the streets. And yet that's the real force, the footage they do show, of the turn that you were describing a couple of minutes ago towards this wider sense of a liberal bias in the press. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's wild. They hold back on street coverage for a few days, in part because the media is being targeted. Like, if you have a 16-millimeter camera, because you can't do live coverage, right, and you're shooting at night, you're going to turn on a light like these lights up here, and that's like a target for the police who will immediately hit the light and knock it out. If you have a still camera with a flashbulb, they're going to knock it out. And so part of the reason they're undercovering the violence is a lot of it's against journalists, and they're like, we don't want to be the story. We want to tell the story, so it's restraint. They also don't want to be unfair to Chicago. They're trying so hard to be objective and fair to Mayor Daley, and not to highlight police brutality until the story becomes overwhelming, which is, you know, Battle of Michigan Avenue. It's like, this is news that we cannot ignore. So they do show some rallies during the daytime when there's tear gas and you know, some brutality, but they kind of hold back. And Cronkite later said in a 1971 interview, it was a kind of double bind, because if they showed all the violence, they would be accused of promoting the violence. You know, like these people want publicity, and that's why it's happening, meaning the protesters. But by undercovering it, it seems more out of nowhere on Wednesday. It seems very sudden, as opposed to this build that had been happening really over the course of a week.
So in that footage that does get on the air, that's the now famous police riot.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how most viewers saw it.
Yeah. It's, looking back on it, people pretty unequivocally are like, this is proof of police brutality that happened in 1968 in Chicago. But at the time, a majority of Americans surveyed evaluated that police action as either a sufficient amount of force or they should have used more force. More than half of Americans. And the idea was, well, network news is biased because they told the story wrong. They didn't, and they were really, the people saying this, some of them were sort of playing off of what Daley said about his complaints. So Daley's complaint was, you didn't show the protesters provoking the police. And it's troubling because it's on so many levels, but his point is, if we'd seen that they were throwing things at police and using foul language and saying threatening things, we would understand why the police beat them, and that would have been appropriate. And of course, it's not appropriate to beat someone for dropping F-bombs, you know, in the street, or for, you know, marching without a permit to beat them, right? So people kind of picked up on that and said, well, if you basically, like, your camera was here showing the crowd, but if you had sort of gone from left to right and shown more and told the story better, we would have seen a more nuanced story about the police. That was the complaint. That's real different from today, where people say, you showed us this image and it just never happened. You know, this is fake. So not that everyone feels that way, and of course sometimes that's accurate because we have deep fakes and stuff like that, but it's a different conception of reality. And I would say, like, the pump is primed by this move towards the media's deceiving us, but it's different to say, you know, you told the story wrong versus you made it up, which is kind of where we're at now.
Yeah. So this leads me to one story that you tell that really struck me. So the great violence, the worst violence in front of the Hilton Hotel on Michigan Avenue, was on the third night of the convention.
Uh-huh.
The next morning, which is the last day of the convention, Lyndon Johnson calls up Frank Stanton, who is the president of CBS, for a little conversation.
Yeah, yeah. We think of Nixon as the great phone call taper, the great taper in general, right? And the great paranoid guy about media coverage and everything. But Johnson had a taping system. So we have records of these phone calls. And he called Frank Stanton, president of CBS. He actually called him right after, so you have the Battle of Michigan Avenue, and the next day Cronkite interviews Mayor Daley on TV right before the convention starts. It's seen as like the worst interview of Cronkite's career, a low point of his career. He was not a strong interviewer in general, everyone knew that. But he just thought Mayor Daley would shoot himself in the foot a little bit because he wasn't super articulate, and he would say things like, the police are not here to prevent disorder, they're here to preserve disorder. That was a typical kind of malapropism from him.
Completely wrong, I'll just say.
Yeah, right. So, you know, he just assumed Daley would kind of be Daley and, you know, it would be a good interview, and it wasn't because Daley had a prepared statement that his PR guys did, and there's a lot of disinformation in that statement. So Cronkite did that to give him sort of equal time, to be fair, and LBJ calls Stanton right after that. And you'd think he'd be like, well, finally you gave the mayor's perspective. But instead, he just rails on Stanton for all of their coverage. And they were friends. And this was an unusual relationship. I mean, LBJ wasn't friends with the ABC guys also and the NBC guys, but he was friends with Stanton. And Cronkite and other people who worked in the newsroom were aware of that relationship. And there was a kind of firewall there that was in place. You know, they felt safe. They never felt like Stanton is going to come down and say, don't do this because LBJ told me or whatever. So it was, you know, it was basically a working relationship that did not impair the news. But at that point, LBJ was just really going at Stanton and said, why are you only covering California? What about Wyoming? Well, there were no stories in Wyoming on the delegate floor, right? I mean, what? The fact was that California was pro-Bobby Kennedy, and Kennedy was no longer in the running because he'd been assassinated. And really, a lot of LBJ's anxiety was just that he hated the Kennedys, and he thought it was a kind of conspiracy to get the Kennedys back in power, that they were covering this wrong. And what I found was, I mean, I meticulously watched hours and hours and hours of footage. And then I was like looking at the time code and everything. Like an hour after Stanton talked on the phone with LBJ, they did their first Wyoming interview. I was like, what the heck? And I'm sure if Cronkite had known, he'd been like, no. just because he was resistant to being bossed around, you know, by the network in that way. But it was not like a huge concession. Wyoming just commented on the nomination of Ed Muskie and said, like, he's a good guy. He's very positive. He likes to make puns, which makes him likable. Was not hard, fast-breaking news. So it's not like a huge story that suddenly they interview Wyoming, but it did point to Stanton was anxious after that phone call, and he obviously reached out to someone and said, you know, talk to some delegates outside of California in the next hour.
And it just does also speak to, maybe in a small way, the intimate relationship between these incredibly powerful people, yeah, and the way that a president could, maybe in a small way, yeah, shape the coverage, yeah, almost immediately.
Yeah, but it was so subtle, and like LBJ was, you know, he would threaten a lot, but you can't compare to Nixon, obviously, right? I mean, Nixon would be like, okay, let's do IRS audits of Dan Rather, of Walter Cronkite, of, you know, everyone he could to kind of, he had this harassment campaign in place that, you know, was not what LBJ was doing. And I mean, here's a like a kind of a esoteric example, but like he was so angry at the Washington Post during Watergate, and I didn't realize till I read Katharine Graham's autobiography that part of how that played out was they owned some TV stations, and they realized he's going to go after our licenses for these TV stations because of our Watergate coverage, and they end up selling the stations, and they're really anxious, and he didn't. It was a threat, but it was really, really heavy-handed compared to what LBJ did.
Yeah, LBJ, there's a lot of bluster.
A lot of bluster, yeah.
LBJ.
Yeah.
So much has happened with the American media landscape in the decades and decades now, half a century since 1968, with the rise of cable TV, with the explosion of social media, with the end of the Fairness Doctrine. Yeah. How do you see what happened in 68, this kind of moment of 68 reverberating through all of the changes that follow?
Wow. I mean, the whole media ecosystem has changed so strongly, and this sense of sort of trust in network news and having a favorite anchor, you know, people who were like, I'm Team Cronkite, I only watch CBS, I'm Huntley Brinkley, I watch NBC, but it wasn't like, I believe in Tucker Carlson and everything he says. You know, it wasn't that kind of more demagogic kind of, you know, following. And also, just to get into the weeds a little bit about how the networks work, like, the news saw itself as doing public service. It, you know, like, yeah, theoretically they wanted high ratings, and they actually got high ratings. They underplayed that because their image was public service, but they were getting solid ratings, selling a lot of advertising time. And most importantly, those news shows, you know, the evening news was the lead-in to the night of TV. So if you started on CBS, you were usually going to stick with CBS for the rest of the night, you know, after the news. And if you started with NBC, you're going to stick with that. And ABC was the lesser player in the news, right? So this, a huge part of what made the news valuable was just that people weren't really using their remotes that much. Remote controls
radically, you know, increase in number when cable comes along because you've got like 100 channels and now we have like 10,000 channels, right? But if you just got a few channels, you can just get up and turn the dial, or better yet, don't. You just stick with CBS, NBC, or ABC, right? So, like, that whole ecosystem is just gone, and now we have this radical kind of individualized media and individualized media streams. And the negative of that is these kind of echo chamber environments where people see tend to see news they agree with. If they follow news, it's going to be within their worldview. The positive side, of course, is that people can take images all over the place. And you can't imagine, like in 68, whatever happens in August here, everyone has a camera in their hand. They can take still photos, they can take audio, they can take video, they can send it out immediately. Hopefully the wrong things won't be amplified and, you know, we will see a mix of materials. But you can't imagine the police being able to stop everyone who's taking pictures. And they didn't do that in 68, but they really tried to. And so that's the positive side, I would say, of one of the positive sides of the current media ecosystem.
And as tempting as it is to ask you to tell us what's going to happen at the convention in August, I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
Partly because there's one thing historians know for sure, it's we're really bad at predicting what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's terrible, yeah.
But I am curious, we were chatting just before the session started, that you teach a course at Northwestern on the media and presidential, or...
Media and American elections.
American elections. Yeah. So I'd love to hear what you're thinking about the ways in which media will play this year's presidential election.
Yeah.
Okay, one thing, journalists have asked me questions along these lines a lot lately, and one thing I say is, like, don't forget about the Republican convention in Milwaukee. That is also important. And don't forget, when you're thinking about protests and really concerned about how many protesters are going to come to the city and what's going to happen and how will the media cover that, don't forget that we have a different kind of right-wing authoritarian sort of situation going on where we may have protesters from the other side, you know, not just people protesting the Biden administration as Democrats or people far left, liberal, but also we may have conservative or right-wing protesters. And how radically different this was from 68. There's no Republicans protesting the Democratic National Convention in 1968. Or, you know, the John Birch Society is not protesting the convention, right? It's hippies and yippies and anti-war protesters. Yeah, so, like, what range of protesters will we get this summer? How will the media cover that? Will they give too much weight to the student protests and Gaza protests as opposed to other kinds of protests who are here, right? Because the fair media coverage would look at everything. Likewise, what are they going to cover in Milwaukee in terms of protests? There's always protests at conventions. You know, it's a matter of magnitude. There's always somebody out in the street protesting, whether it's Vietnam veterans against the war or, you know, the Proud Boys more recently, right? And so if the Republican convention, one of the mistakes in 68 was that the Republican convention in Miami came across as completely orderly, everything was perfect there. What a perfect media show. And it was, because everything happened behind the scenes. Nixon is forging the Southern strategy with Strom Thurmond in a hotel room, you know, and talking to other Southern people about, you know, to make them not vote for George Wallace, just to get in the weeds of the whole electoral process. But it's all happening off stage. And there is an uprising in a black neighborhood just a few miles away. And people are killed, and tear gas trucks are out. And, you know, it's on fire. I mean, it's a disaster. And the networks didn't cover that as relevant to the convention. And they were wrong. It was relevant to the convention. And they got it, like Reuben Frank, who was NBC's news guy, wrote a book called, I can't remember, but read it. It's good. And he says, yeah, maybe we got that wrong. He acknowledged, like, yeah, I think that was relevant. We just didn't see it as relevant. Because our sense going into the convention was it's going to be orderly, it's Republicans. And our sense going into Chicago is it's going to be disorderly because of the war. And those perceptions played out in the coverage.
They frame the story.
You see what you expect to see to some extent. So you don't want that this summer from the media, like, well, the Republicans going to go great and this is going to be chaos. Like, you've got to really fully cover both of the stories.
And do you feel that the to borrow a phrase, the mainstream media, does that affect as effectively now as it was able to do in 68, more effectively now than in 68?
I mean, so many of the same journalistic standards are just firmly in place. People go to journalism school and they learn about what it means to attempt to be fair in reporting. They are realistic about the fact that nobody is objective and that everyone brings a point of view, a perspective to the coverage. The network guys and gals, but mostly guys, in the 60s were aware they had a perspective. You know, we think of it as very contemporary to say, like, oh, that guy is white and male middle class. They were, like, aware we're white, male, middle class. That impacts our coverage, you know. People are still aware of their own positioning today, and I think really do strive quite often for, in the mainstream media, for that kind of fairness and objectivity and, to a fault to some extent, right? We saw the both sides-ism critiques coming out during the Trump years, and it took them, 4 years to figure out we are amplifying Trump way too much. We're covering every single rally in a way we have not for other candidates. And that was a slow process, and it's probably still a work in progress, right? I argue that in Chicago, the networks figured out in like 3 days, oh, this is police brutality. We don't have to balance it with an interview with the police to say why it's not police brutality. Objectively, that's what's happening, and we're just going to show it. We're going to turn on the camera and show what's happening. So for there's a handful of mistakes they did make, like we talked about earlier, but they basically got it right. So I have concerns about how well the media coverage is going to go, but I feel very positively about the status of the mainstream journalism. We were losing newspapers, we got a lot of issues, right, with mainstream journalism. But in terms of professional norms and what they're striving for, what I see is a very similar picture of professionalism within the mainstream media.
One obvious difference with the ways in which the professional standards are applied is who's applying them, right? Mm-hmm. That, as you said, the main networks in 68 were overwhelmingly white and male, mm-hmm. and middle class, upper class, connected with, as we were talking about, with Frank Stanton, right?
Yep.
They've become more diverse places to some extent. Do you
That's
think
true.
That has made that has an impact in the ways in which narratives get built?
Absolutely. In the 60s, following the Kerner Commission report, right, in the late 60s, the networks were hyper aware, like, we need to hire more people of color. We really have to try. What do we do? All right, but there are not enough people of color in journalism school. So we have to recruit people, we have to train them, we have to find a way, because we're not just gonna be able to fix journalism schools right away. We have to find a way to work around to get more people of color hired. And they made an effort, and they didn't always succeed, but they tried. And yeah, there's a transformation now in terms of not 100%, but a lot more people of color working. And of course, that's going to shape coverage in the streets of a convention or during the Black Lives Matter protests, right? So it's certainly relevant to how stories are being told, even, just who's being interviewed.
Yeah.
I mean, here's a great example. Cronkite has a kind of epiphanic moment during some of the street violence on Wednesday night, right, the Battle of Michigan Avenue, not just the scene of the big police brutality beating, but like interviews with people on the side of the street, and there's a man and a woman who are middle-aged, and the woman is wearing pearls, and the man has on a tie, and they've just come from, a banquet or a steak dinner or something, the opera.
Or Evanston.
Evanston, right. They're, and Cronkite is like, people of standing in the community are calling the network. And people weren't, they're seeing violence and they know they can't call the police because the police are doing the violence. And they call the networks instead. Hmm. It's wild. Just phone calls, telegrams, what the hell is going on? So you get negative phone calls and telegrams, but you also get just like treating them like, we don't know what to do, just come show this thing. And so Cronkite sees these people of substance in the community being interviewed, and people of substance in the community being beaten and falling through the window of the Haymarket Hotel, and people with little handbags and, formal, people, not just hippies and yippies. And he's very sympathetic to the hippies and yippies, I want to add. He really was. But it makes him realize depth of this, that this is not, if you come to Chicago as a protester, in a sense you know there's a threat of violence. If you're walking through downtown after dinner, trying to go home, you don't assume that the police will beat you for being there, for being on the sidewalk, or for passing through on a bike, or whatever. Yeah. So that was a big moment for him. And also, here's something we haven't had time to talk about, and it's not central in the book, but like the context of 68 is also international turmoil and an international yes. youth movement, an international peace movement. And in May 68, you've got kids in Paris in the streets doing barricades, being attacked by police, and that's, you know, and in Prague during the convention,
the same
people are holding signs saying Chicago. Like C-Z-E-C-H, you know,
really?
Chicago. Yeah,
oh,
yeah. So there's an awareness.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So we're running out of time. I just want to say again, congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge about this extraordinary moment with everyone and with me. Thank you so much.
It was really great talking to you. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.